Playing around with my little Jornada here that has a little digital audio recorder on it, and for the first time yesterday, I had an actual recording of the class, and I'm starting to put that on your the web page. I eventually want to get the. There's a system where I can use the lapel mic, and it's better audio. This one's a little bit it's not as good. The audio quality is not as good, I'm put it that way. In any event, I was also trying to punch up the website, but I can't get the computer to. It's a little glitches here. The bottom line is, if you go to the website, which is on your CD. It has a little update thing. In the update portion, there is a link to audio files for the summer. So if you miss a class or if there's a part you really want to go back and listen to again, you should be able to download that that part of the class, assuming I'm able to get these audio files posted. Okay, one other point about res ipsa that I wanted to sort of emphasize, it's not actually part of the rules, but it's a way of rule of thumb. Res ipsa cases apply where there's missing evidence, where something about the way the accident happened destroyed the usual process. The dynamite explosion is a classic example. None were left to tell the tale. The elevator case is one not nearly as dramatic, but one where the kind of evidence gets chewed up in the normal. In other words, did somebody flip the wrong switch? Did somebody leave a wrench where it wasn't supposed to be? That kind of evidence has disappeared through the normal functioning of the elevator. Did the failure of the brakes get chewed up in the subsequent automobile crash? So again, the classic place where res ipsa applies is where, for one reason or another, I'm missing the kind of evidence that I would ordinarily look to in judging whether or not the defendant was negligent. Okay, let's turn then to the next method of proving the defendant's negligence. In fact, I believe it's the last one here. Smith versus Walmart. After that, the Stevens case. Ms. Cook, can you tell us about Walmart? A little louder, please, there. I was having trouble hearing you there. Just a little bit louder, please.
The plaintiff's husband, Joel, also died.
Okay. So her claim against Walmart is that they were negligent in failing to have something to prevent her from slipping. And so what's the issue in this case? What happened at trial that generated this appeal? Slow down. Okay. Let's start with the first part of it, which is what's at stake here is the admissibility of what you call a post-accident repair. And what are the facts of that post-accident repair? What is this? What are we talking about?
The post-accident repair.
Yeah. Okay, And why is that, why was that brought into evidence? If you're the plaintiff, what good does that do? Yeah, the defendant's doing after the fact what the plaintiff suggests to the jury they should have done before the fact. Plaintiff slipping and falling shows, oh gee, we need to put the mats out. And plaintiff suggests to the jury, well, you know, they should have thought of that earlier. Okay. What's the ordinary rule with respect to these post-accident repairs? Again, in a nutshell here, doing the sort of IRAC method, if you've got an issue, can you get this into evidence? What's the R in IRAC, the rule here? Post-accident repairs are inadmissible, generally inadmissible, to prove negligence. Now, it turns out they can be used to prove other things, but the ordinary rule is that, well, why not? What's the rationale behind this rule? Yes, it's a kind of don't bite the hand that feeds you. Why should we punish the defendant for, after the fact, taking what society wants them to do, which is additional precaution? So you can imagine lots of cases where, for example, there's a horrible traffic accident. Some kid is seriously injured on a bicycle, and the city then puts up a stop sign at this intersection, whereas before, like, lots of intersections in Spokane, they're all unmarked. They're blind intersections. So somebody, you know, puts up a stop sign. If that were admissible against the city to show that they were negligent in not putting it up before, they would hesitate to do that. So, in order to keep this disincentive from keeping life more dangerous than it needs to be, we say you can't use that post-accident repair evidence to show that the defendant should have done it before. Now, continuing with the rule here, there are exceptions to the rule. I stopped you as you were listing them off. They're inadmissible. Except when what? Actually, you had them listed in order there. Okay, so the first one is to prove ownership. Let's say, for example, that I get injured at the Northtown Mall, and I claim that it was the negligence of somebody in the food court who left something, some spilled item on the floor, and that's what I slipped on. And the defendant's response to my claim of negligence is, it wasn't our responsibility. That part of the food court was not our responsibility. It belonged to the landlord, or it belonged to the Barnes & Noble, or Sears, or somebody else. If the defendant contests ownership of the scene of the accident, or the thing that caused the accident, you can use a post-accident repair to prove it. So if the people at Ivor's fish place over at the mall say that wasn't our territory, well, I can show up, but an Ivor's employee came out to clean it up. I'm not using to show they were negligent. I'm using to show they acknowledged through their behavior that they owned it, which they are now disputing. Mr. Stubbs?
hear a lot of people talk about how they keep all of their assets in other people's names, things like that, because just in case they get a lawsuit. So what if somebody's parents, you know, technically have ownership of someone's car, someone plows into someone else, but could they use this proof of ownership if they're the ones that paid for the car?
Again, if the defendant is disputing ownership, it's a relatively rare occurrence. Most of the time, the defendant's stuck. Yeah, that's my car, as a matter of fact. But in those cases where, as I suggested to you, somebody gets hurt in the mall and the defendant's response is, not my property, not my instrument or piece of equipment, but the defendant then acts after the accident as though it were, I can use that evidence to contradict it. Second exception. Okay. And I'm going to put as a sort of caveat to both of these things, if disputed. In other words, I can't introduce the evidence to prove feasibility unless, or to prove ownership, unless the defendant has put this in question. Feasibility relates to the compatibility of the proposed safety measure. So there was a case in Washington, for example, of somebody who worked at a motel, and it was in a pretty tough section of town, and he complained about his vulnerability to assault, and sure enough, one night, somebody came into the motel with a gun, and eventually he was shot. After this armed robbery, they put in plate glass, you know, bulletproof glass. Now, at trial, the plaintiff argued that the defendant was negligent in not having bulletproof glass to protect the guy working behind the counter. I forget why workers' comp wasn't involved. It's the franchise against the national chain or something like that. In any event, the defendant's argument was, well, you know, we really can't put a plate glass because it's kind of bad for business. You know, you walk into the motel, getting ready to check in, and here's the employee behind bulletproof glass. Is there bulletproof glass behind my room? And why does he need it? And if he needs it, maybe I do too. So again, you could plausibly say a reasonable person wouldn't go to this extreme because it would destroy business. Well, if you put feasibility in play, or you argue, well, I couldn't put that on the lawnmower because it would slow the lawnmower down or make it not start or what have you. If I have evidence that the defendant did the very thing later that they're now claiming was not feasible, again, I can use that to establish feasibility if it's being contested. Again, oftentimes the defendant's argument is not that the proposed safety measure wasn't feasible, but simply wasn't required by reasonable care. I could have done that, sure, but I didn't. That's not something a reasonable person would have done. What's the third exception? I don't think that's an exception. Yes, that's another one. The expression that you sometimes hear in criminal cases and elsewhere with regard to some point that somebody wants to keep out is that the other party opened the door. So, for example, in criminal cases, ordinarily the defendant's past is not something the prosecutor can use to establish the defendant's guilt. The fact that I have 5 previous convictions for armed robbery is not relevant in a prosecution against me for armed robbery unless I open the door by trying to persuade the jury that I'm a marvelous human being, never been in trouble with the law. It's completely implausible to think that I would have robbed this bank. Well, if I bring up the issue of my character, open the door, then the prosecution can say, well, now that we're talking about character, let's tell the jury what his real record is. So again, if the defendant brings up this post-accident repair, then the plaintiff can, having the door opened by the defendant, can then use that evidence in their own case. Okay, do any of these three issues apply? Yes, not just in the Walmart store, but the defendant opened the door to the testimony. How? How did the defendant open the door? Apparently, one of the witnesses for the defendant, not quite with the program here, and it's very easy for this to happen. One of your challenges as a lawyer is that your clients have their own ideas about what's going to help and what's not going to help, and in their desire to help, they often do the wrong thing. And in this case, the manager testifies about, you know, to prove to you that Walmart's a place with a heart, you know, that they didn't, that they were concerned about these things, that they were pedaling as fast as they could. They said, well, right after she fell, will we take the mats out? Oh, thank you very much. So something they could have kept out, the defendant introduced on their own hook. Moreover, I think there's some question in this case as to whether or not they properly objected to it. So, for example, the defendant's lawyer, who maybe is examining the manager on this point, and the manager gets off the track, is off the script, the defendant could ask for that to be, you know, stricken from the record. Didn't do that. Left it in. So, again, the defendant, through their own acquiescence, a little bit like the turntable case we originally had, something which you might have been entitled to if you properly asserted it at the time, if you acquiesce and let the thing go, you're prevented from objecting to it later on. So again, the ordinary rule in these cases is that however juicy it might be for the plaintiff to show that the defendant acknowledged the need for the safety precaution by immediately doing it right after the accident, that is the you know, the fruit of the forbidden tree. Of that you may not eat. So unless you can fall into one of these exceptions, then the defendant can essentially avoid the use of these by their own behavior. That is, the defendant can say, yes, it was my property, or yes, it was my piece of equipment. The defendant can say, I concede that the thing you're asking, that you're suggesting to the jury should have been done, I'm not contesting whether it was feasible or not. I'm just saying you can't use the evidence of what we did later to prove we should have done it before. Now, I want to shift to a slightly different topic here in the trolley case. They're conceptually related in that they have to do with policies the employer adopts with regard to safety, but obviously it has a different outcome, and one of the things we want to do is sort of probe why the different outcome. Mr. Parzik, is that how you say it?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us what's to you.
The plaintiff, she was sued for a personal injury sustained while crossing the intersection when she was struck by a streetcar. The motorman or driver of the streetcar, by the rules of the company, was fired to sound a gong when a streetcar approached the intersection. In this case, the gong was not sounded, and
Okay. So, so what happens at the trial of the case?
Verdict and judgment before the plan, and the defendant appeals on the grounds that certain evidence has been submitted to the jury.
Okay.
On the grounds that there is an account principle under which the evidence.
Okay. And this is obviously a much earlier than the Walmart case, but let's suppose, just for the sake of a little thought experiment here, that you had the Walmart case talking about post-accident repairs. Why could you argue as a defendant that evidence like this should not be admissible? You're the defendant. You're trying to keep out evidence that the defendant had a policy in advance encouraging its motorman to sound this bell as they entered an intersection. What leverage could you get from the Walmart, or the principle announced in the Walmart case? Obviously, the defendant loses in Walmart, but the principle about post-accident repair. I'm confusing you here, obviously, because this is not a post-accident repair, but maybe the principle is analogous. Mr. Glover?
Maybe companies want to adopt safety policies that they know they're going to be used against in the court.
Okay. Could you make a similar policy argument that just as we don't want to discourage people from engaging in safety precautions after an accident, doesn't a rule that makes their safety policies prior to the accident available to be used against them, doesn't that mean that if you were the lawyer representing the trolley company and the supervisor consults with you, gee, we're drawing up a list of rules and regulations for trolley operators, wouldn't you as a lawyer, on the strength of this sort of principle, encourage the employer, gee, don't put anything down on paper, that's only going to come back to bite you later on? Everything you put down, you know, you put down something in the trolley regulations that say where you have an infirm or elderly passenger and you know, you're still on schedule, if your schedule permits, help such passengers on and off the trolley. Well, if you've got that rule, or even sort of encouragement, and some elderly or infirm passenger falls getting on or off the trolley, they're going to point to that and say, hey, see, by your own rules, you're supposed to do that. So will the net result of a rule allowing this evidence to be admissible, won't the natural effect of that be to discourage people from doing the things we want them to do, which is to set the bar higher and encourage greater safety precautions? Mr. Lynch? That's a very good point, that this is one way, but certainly not the only way you can get in trouble. If I'm running a trolley system, my goal is minimize the number of preventable accidents. I got to make sure my employees are not drunk on the job, that they drive within the speed limit. Will it hurt me to have a rule that says employees who have been drinking shall not take the controls of a trolley? Employees shall keep their vehicle within the speed limit. Will I be worse off by having that rule? Not really, because even if I didn't have that rule, if my employees are drunk or if they're speeding, the jury's likely to find that they were negligent. So, to the extent that my rules simply state good behavior in general, having the rule doesn't particularly increase the likelihood that juries are going to find my people negligent. It may be very important to state clearly, don't go out and have a 3-martini lunch on your lunch break. If you're driving a trolley, you've got to be sober. And similarly with the speed limit and so forth. And I may get more mileage as an employer out of adopting rules that reduce the number of accidents than those few accidents where the use of this evidence might be used to put me in a less favorable light. So you could argue that, in fact, this won't have the perverse effect that I was worried about with respect to the post-accident repair. Therefore, as a policy matter, I can have a rule that makes what I would call these rule book violations. The assumption being that the employer has a rule book of some kind, maybe written down, maybe not, maybe simply a series of practices which are reinforced, communicated, some sort of regular communication, oral reminders, etc. We have some kind of a rule book. This is the way we do our job. And a violation of that is admissible. So again, the contrast here in the way the law treats these is that rule book violations like this one, established before the accident, where those are violated, the violation is admissible to establish negligence. Now, the court draws the analogy to a statutory violation, but they want to make it clear they're not the same. A requirement, thou shalt not speed, set by the legislature has a different status from a rule established by the employer. Thou shalt sound a gong before entering an intersection. The employer's violation doesn't have the force of law, whereas the statutory requirement does have the force of law. So whereas Cardoza can say the jury is in no position to dispense with the statutory violation, a jury could say, well, yeah, the employer asked all employees to sweep the sidewalk or shovel the sidewalk or what have you, rake the leaves, put out mats, before opening the store. The fact that the employee didn't do that is only evidence of negligence, and the jury could say, well, that was a nice idea, but it wasn't really something required by our standard of reasonable care. Nonetheless, as a plaintiff, you're very happy to find a deviation from the employer's expectations, the employer's rule book, because you're imposing on the employer a standard they set for themselves. Pretty hard if you're the employer to say, oh yeah, we had that rule, but we weren't negligent in not following it. It's a very, very desirable, strong piece of evidence, Mr. Covey. If I were the lawyer and the employer asked me, we'd like to stick this in, but we'd like to give ourselves some maneuvering room in case we get sued over this, I would basically say, you're not going to help yourself a whole lot by putting it in this kind of aspirational language. Either make it a requirement or don't make it a requirement, but leaving it in this kind of loosey-goosey fashion, you're still going to get hurt the jury's still going to look at that as something that the employee should have done, or it reinforces the plaintiff's argument that a reasonable person would have done that. So if you want it in there, put it in there, and then follow it up. Don't have a whole series of rules which you expect to be broken on a regular basis. If you have policies and procedures, make sure your employees follow them. That's just sort of good business, good management. Having a longer list where you're, you know, hoping 80% of them will get obeyed, you know, sort of a bad policy in general. Okay, so again, whether you can, I mean, I'm being a little adventurous here in comparing the two. What you want to take away from this section is the difference in the legal status of the two kinds of evidence. Evidence of post-accident repairs is ordinarily inadmissible. Evidence of pre-accident rule book standards that were violated by the employee are admissible. So far, so good. All right, Ms. P.
So does this explain why after Walmart Texas about a week and a half ago, they took a week to change the thing that caused that got run over by the truck?
Good question.
Maybe looking back at this case and going, man, we did something right away, man, we better kind of leave it alive.
Well, waiting a week doesn't really help you. And in many ways, you can think of maybe this doesn't hurt us legally, but it's going to certainly strengthen. And maybe you can't tell the jury about it, but it's hard to say with a straight face, oh, we didn't need to do that.
In fact, I think the only reason why they did...
What did they do, by the way? Do you all know the case a lady was... An elderly lady was at Walmart. She falls off the sidewalk or whatever it is.
And it was crammed with plants. There was no room.
Okay.
She stand on the sidewalk. My truck was semi-truck. I'm holding plants back up.
Yeah.
But there was no room to hop onto the sidewalk.
And
she was still moving.
The walker.
Yeah.
There was no room for her and her walker on the sidewalk.
Okay.
Her walker went.
Yeah.
But what I noticed was that people were writing letters to the editor every day saying, it's been 2 days they haven't moved those plants. It's been 3 days they haven't moved those plants. It's been 6 days and they haven't moved those plants.
Well, again, Walmart, not only from a liability standpoint, it may be that whatever they do after the accident is legally inadmissible. But from the standpoint of negotiating with the, you know, plaintiff's estate, let's suppose her son is the a beneficiary of her estate and he's the one filing a claim on her behalf. Again, in Chapter 3 you get into all sorts of interesting questions. Well, what are the damages for an elderly lady whose you know, time on earth is cut short by a semi? You know, we don't have any wage loss. We, you know, what's that case worth? Kind of an imponderable question, but let's suppose it's, you know, let's pick an arbitrary number. Suppose it's worth $100,000 if you can establish liability. Well, from Walmart's perspective, maybe the evidence about their negligence or about what they did afterward is not admissible to prove they should have done it earlier. But in terms of trying to negotiate something with the son, if they change what they do afterward, sort of in response to all this criticism, it bolsters the son into thinking they should have done it earlier. It encourages him to think, I could persuade a jury that what they had earlier was a bad idea. Whereas if they keep it the way it was and say, we're terribly sorry about your mother, but after all, you know, it's just something in fact, I saw the news reports of it on TV. They didn't cite anybody, and I was sort of like, this is just terrible, tragic accident that was nobody's fault. And again, Walmart may have trouble selling that to the claimant, and the claimant's going to go find a claimant's lawyer to represent them. Once they find that, Walmart, in effect, acknowledged their guilt by changing the way they arranged these things. And this is the reason for the policy. This is why post-accident repairs are legally inadmissible. That's not where we should be arguing what they did afterward, because it may be, we didn't want to look like we were insensitive, or, if people want this, fine, we're here to kind of, no harm making people going the extra mile to do something people seem to want. Well, the line that's drawn is that these are all things that happened before the accident. So in that sense, we're not troubled by all of these questions. Well, was this in response to some, desire to appear to be bending over backwards to be sensitive to these people? Was it, a little kid is mangled on a bicycle, and so we put a stop sign up at the intersection. Okay, this is a way to sort of show workplace from apart. That concern about the validity of the evidence isn't present with respect to pre-accident safety policies. The employer adopted this not just after an accident. The employer adopted this before the accident, and therefore it has a greater degree of reliability. I think that's part of the rationale. But what makes life easy for you is, regardless of the reasoning for it, whether you find yourself satisfied with the reasoning, there's a nice, clear, bright line. Post-accident, invisible, except for these exceptions. Pre-accident, fair game. Okay, now, let me summarize the fact that we have all these different methods to try to prove the defendant was negligent. We can use the juror's own experience. We can use industry custom. We can use statutory violations. We can use res ipsa. We can use rulebook violations. We can't use post-accident repairs unless there's some kind of exception to that rule. And as I look at a fact pattern, again, if you go back looking at previous exams, the thing I would suggest that you do is see if I can pick through a fact pattern and say, here's where I use res ipsa, here's where I use negligence per se, here's where I use industry custom, here's where I use this other thing, and then you compare. Look at the sample answer, see if your instinct as to what's useful here, what's not useful, is matched by my read of the same fact. And I think that will give you a pretty good idea of whether or not you're mastering this stuff. Okay, now, in the last 8 minutes that we have here, I just want to get started on this next section about vicarious liability. And it's not really a new theory, not a new basis for liability. It's only a way of, in effect, transferring the responsibility from the immediate person who caused the harm to somebody with better financial resources. I don't want the truck driver held responsible for this elderly woman's death, or the manager of the garden section. I want a big corporation that's got a big insurance policy to be held liable. And to do that, I've got to draw the legal connection between the little guy, so to speak, and the employer or the organization for whom this person works. Now, in a way, this is an area that bleeds into another aspect of law. There's a whole course that you take on, I think it's called business association. It used to be called agency and partnership. So the law of agency, when someone is an agent, this relationship of principal and agent has all sorts of complications to it. You know, when is the principal responsible for the agent's behavior? The agent signs a contract. Does that bind the principal? What if the principal tells the agent to do it within certain parameters? So there's lots of other interesting stuff that you will consider elsewhere, but we need a little sliver of this right now, because oftentimes you have a big issue in a tort case about who can be held responsible. And the case we use for it is Hayes versus Far West. It's an interesting little case. Helps to illustrate the principles that are involved. So I'll take a volunteer here, somebody who's read the case. Mr. Rubio, why don't you tell us about Hayes?
The plaintiff is an attorney who...
Actually, the plaintiff's not the attorney. Plaintiff's the victim.
The victim.
Okay.
Plaintiff is a victim who happens to be an attorney.
No. Anyway, well...
I'm sorry. Plaintiff is a victim. I got it back.
Okay, go ahead.
Plaintiff is a victim who encounters goes to a bar, and there's an attorney who is speaking about business, and he's talking about his law firm and someone negotiating. They have an exchange of words, and in the process...
And I don't think it was about reciprocator either. okay. Probably had to do with, some woman in the bar or whatever. Go ahead.
They have an exchange of words, and eventually at the end, they end up leaving the bar, and they continue to have an exchange of words that ends up being like an altercation. And the plaintiff ends up taking out a gun, which he feels is necessary to defend himself. And he shoots the
And it's not the plaintiff who takes out the gun, it's the lawyer who takes out the gun and shoots the plaintiff. It's not... the dispute resolution law school. Okay. So, but the plaintiff is not limiting his, obviously this lawyer's got other problems. The lawyer's liability in this case is not what's at issue. The question in this case is the liability of what or whom? Of his employer. Okay, so the question in the case is, can the plaintiff hold the law firm responsible for the shooting in a parking lot? Now, why don't you just give us in a few words what the general rule is for holding employers responsible for what employees do? An employer is responsible when
the employee is acting in the course and scope of the employment.
Okay. And in the course and scope of the employment, injures someone else. Negligent. Now, there's no question shooting this guy in the parking lot would fall within bad behavior. The question is whether he's in the course and scope of employment. Now, well, obviously we're going to have to pick this up tomorrow, but just while we've got a few more minutes, the plaintiff, in order to establish the law firm's responsibility, the plaintiff wants to draw on what case?
He wants to draw on Dickens versus Edwards.
Dickinson, yes. And in the Dickinson case, what happens?
Yeah, there's an employee at a banquet, and he has too much to drink, ends up driving home cause of action, hurt somebody, injure someone.
Okay, now, the question is whether the employer who hosted the banquet is liable for this auto accident that takes place later on the highway. Let me be real careful about this. Was the employee out on the highway at the time the accident occurred in Dickinson? Was the employee at that moment in the course and scope of his employment?
No.
But was the employer liable?
Yes.
Why?
Because the consumption of alcohol was in the course and scope of the employment.
In effect, the accident didn't start out there on the highway. The accident started at the point where the employee consumed too much alcohol, and that was in the course and scope of his employment. Nice work if you can get it. It turns out it was part of his job to consume alcohol, not consume it to excess. But his job included the consumption of alcohol, and therefore when he mistakenly, negligently overconsumes, the court holds, that negligence eventually caused the accident, and for that the employer is accountable. The issue in our case here with the lawyer is whether or not he did something analogous that was negligent in the course and scope of his employment. And we'll have to pick up with that tomorrow.
More maybe,